When you drive a vehicle so reliable it's backed by a 10-year, 100,000-mile limited warranty, you stop thinking about what you can't do and start doing what you never thought possible. Visit your local Kia dealer today to see what you're capable of in a vehicle that inspires confidence around every corner. Kia. Movement that inspires.
Call 800-333-4KIA for details. Always drive safely. Limited inventory available. Warranties include 10-year, 100,000-mile powertrain and 5-year, 60,000-mile basic. Warranties are limited. See retailer for details.
Step into the world of power, loyalty, and luck.
I'm going to make him an offer he can't refuse.
With family, cannolis, and spins mean everything.
Now, you want to get mixed up in the family business.
Introducing The Godfather at ChumbaCasino.com. Test your luck in the shadowy world of The Godfather slot.
Someday, I will call upon you to do a service for me.
Play The Godfather now at ChumbaCasino.com.
Welcome to the family.
VGW Group. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
History isn't just a bunch of names and dates and facts. It's the collection of all the stories throughout human history that explain how and why we got here. Welcome to the History Unplugged podcast, where we look at the forgotten, neglected, strange, and even counterfactual stories that made our world what it is. I'm your host, Scott Rank. The first global manhunt was for a British pirate in the 17th century. The pirate in question was Henry Avery, the most notorious pirate of the age. The British press put out wildly popular and wildly inaccurate reports of his adventures. The government offered enormous bounties for his capture, whether alive or dead. But his true legacy wasn't the global manhunt. It could have been that he inadvertently triggered a major shift in the global economy. Today's guest is Stephen Johnson, author of the book Enemy of All Mankind, a true story of piracy, power, and history's first global manhunt. The reason that Avery was the target of this manhunt was because of the attack of an Indian treasure ship worth millions of dollars by him and his crew, and the enormous repercussions that it had. It threatened trade between India's Mughal Empire and Britain itself, and led to the rise of the East India Company. This international corporation is one of the forerunners that led to today's densely interconnected planet ruled by nations and corporations. So how did a pirate and a simple raid on a ship lead to the birth of multinational capitalism? In this episode, we get into all these different things and talk about how one seemingly small event can trigger all sorts of different cascades. So I hope you enjoyed this discussion with Stephen Johnson. Stephen, welcome to the show.
Hey, it's my pleasure to be with you.
All right. Well, I am very excited to talk to you about the world of piracy, one particular pirate, and the effect he had on the global economy. And I'd like to enter into this world of piracy in the 17th century. So what is it about this time period when there's so much piracy? Because on the one hand, piracy is a universal phenomena in humankind. As long as there's any sort of trade that involves shipping, there are pirates. But there's not the same level of piracy in, say, the 16th century, nor the 19th century. So why is there so much piracy happening at the time period in which your book takes place?
Yeah, it's a really interesting period, I think, in part because the world is changing very rapidly, and also the kind of understanding of what piracy is changing. And for your listeners who may not have spent as much time as I have thinking about piracy over the last couple of years, the first thing to kind of orient yourself is that the golden age of piracy that Pirates of the Caribbean is based on, and that you hear, the kind of Blackbeard kind of era, that is about 20 or 30 years after the events of this book, kind of early 1700, 1720, 1730. That's that Sam Bellamy period that that every kid kind of hears about in terms of piracy. But piracy is a much older practice, as you say. It goes back thousands and thousands of years. But in the 1600s, there's this interesting evolution that's starting to take place, which is that piracy was a kind of semi-legitimate practice. And there was this very blurry line between what was called privateering and piracy. And so you had people like Sir Francis Drake, who was effectively just a kind of like a ruthless pirate, who nonetheless, because he kind of cleverly avoided attacking British ships and basically did all this piracy against kind of enemies of Great Britain. He was able to kind of return to England and, you know, be knighted and be seen as a completely legitimate force, ended up buying a like fancy estate, even though he was completely a pirate. And that's the kind of period leading up to the events of this book. And what, in a sense, what starts to happen over the course of this book is that that kind of blurry line no longer becomes tenable. Like the world has to decide, like, are pirates outlaws? Are they criminals, or are they kind of legitimate businessmen, you know, who happen to do their trade by, you know, attacking other ships and looting them? That's the kind of the question that's at the core of this story.
I love pirates because, as you said, there's a blurry line between somebody who is accepted in society as a proper navalman, a naval officer, and a robber, a bandit who happens to be on the seas. And in the Ottoman Empire, which I've talked a lot about on this podcast, almost all the admirals of the golden age of the Ottoman Navy were former pirates. So Henry Every, what's his background? Did he have any sort of legitimacy at the beginning of his career, or was he always illegitimate?
Well, he's kind of a mystery. That's one of the things that makes him so fascinating, I think, as a character, is that we know very little about his life before kind of 1693, 1694, this very brief window where he goes from being almost entirely unknown, having left almost no trace in the historical record, to being one of the most famous sought after people in the world. And then he disappears again. So there's this like tiny little slice of his life that is incredibly public. And everything before that is really pretty blurry. We don't even know really where he's born. In fact, we don't really know his name. It's interesting. Like half the time he's referred to as Henry Avery. In fact, one of the weird things that I had to wrestle with in writing this book was, how was I going to spell his name? Because it's sometimes spelled Avery, sometimes spelled Avery. And he had other kind of pseudonyms that he seems to have gone under as well. So he's a very mysterious figure. There's some evidence that he was in the Royal Navy. And we do believe that he was, in a sense, what's known as an interloper in the slave trade. He may have been an actual slave trader, and then he may have also been somebody who was basically functioning as almost like a pirate inside of the slave trade. But there's really very little evidence of what he did for most of his life. All we know is that he kind of signed up for this voyage in 1693, 1694, that's where really his true story begins, and in a sense where the story of the book begins.
Yeah. So what voyage does he sign up for, and what happens that he earns this sobriquet, enemy of all mankind, which, hey, great title for the book, by the way. That was catchy when I saw it.
Well, it's interesting, you know, just a word about the title. It's a technical legal term that was invented to describe pirates inside of kind of the law, the structures of the law, because piracy posed this problem to legal systems, which was most of their crimes were committed in international waters. And so it was not clear who had jurisdiction. If the law was going to be against pirates, it was figured out a way to like rein in piracy. It wasn't clear who had the authority to do that if the crimes were taking place outside of the kind of boundaries of nation states. And so this new definition was created, enemy of all mankind. And so these people were committing crimes that were somehow kind of globally offensive and thus could be tried in different jurisdictions. And that actual category, it's interesting, was ultimately then kind of reapplied in the 20th century and 21st century to be used with terrorists, in a sense where, you know, somebody who was committing a crime somewhere else in the world, it was so egregious that they were considered an enemy of all mankind and they could be tried and, in any court or a court in the United States, for instance. And that was used actually in the post 9/11 era, to justify some of the interventions that happened with Al-Qaeda in that period. And so there's actually an interesting connection between pirates and terrorists that's kind of woven through the book as well. But that's a little backstory on the title, which is a pretty fun one, I think.
Yeah, I mean, just as an aside, when we say piracy today, usually we think of some fat dude who has thousands of movies that he's illegally downloaded and he's distributing on torrent networks and all that, which is piracy. Piracy, as I understand, is the robbing of goods of other people. But I guess I've never really thought through the legal definition of piracy, because then there's also this understanding of operating outside one particular nation state jurisdiction in international waters. And is that also the understanding of piracy as we apply it today? Or have we misunderstood it in its traditional term? Or are we properly using it today?
There's still some of that that happens, right? I mean, there's still, you know, the Somali pirates, for instance, which actually are in a very similar place of the world, where the crimes that happen in this book are very close to kind of today's most famous pirates, notorious pirates. So there's kind of a general definition of piracy, which could involve like stealing copyrighted material. But for the most part, we're talking about piracy in terms of a ship coming alongside another ship and firing some cannons and all the things that you think of when you think about pirates. But the other thing that we should say, you know, there are two kind of general contextual things here that are, I think are really fascinating to me. The first is that the actual kind of pirate economic system, if you worked on a pirate ship as a pirate in 1690, these pirate ships were some of the most progressive economic organizations on the planet, arguably the most progressive economic organization on the planet. They shared the loot that they gathered in a much more equitable way than, you know, any other existing organization in that period. Oftentimes a captain would just get two, you know, shares for everyone else getting one share. So basically everyone would divide the loot evenly. They had these extraordinary insurance systems. Like if you lost a leg in battle, you would get extra loot. They were little floating democracies. Like you could vote out the captain, you could vote out the quartermaster. There was kind of a division of power between the captain and the quartermaster. And so there's been some arguments by other scholars that have said, like, you know, this is actually in some ways one of the kind of seedbeds of, you know, a more egalitarian set of political systems and economic systems actually starts with the pirates. So while they're criminals, and in many cases they're terrible people and they commit acts of atrocious violence, there is also this weird kind of almost utopian kind of radical thread that runs through what they're doing. So that's part of the context here. And the other thing here is that when you think about this period, there are a whole set of kind of definitions, not just around piracy, that are still taking shape. Like what are the limits of a nation, right? Like what are the legal limits of a nation? There's a corporation at the center of this story, the East India Company, which we'll get to. What is the role of a multinational corporation in the world? People were just inventing these things for the first time, and they didn't quite understand like what their responsibilities were. And so what happens in this story is, because piracy is this kind of edge case, it ends up like running up against all these weird blurry lines that haven't been defined yet and forcing people to kind of actually define those lines. That's why historically I think this story is so important.
It's interesting you mentioned the diverse character of piracy. And I had a guest who hosts a show called the Pirate History Podcast. And there are cases of female pirates who were led to notorious criminal scandals and or trials back in England. Multiracial crews and chances for diversity that you wouldn't see on a typical HMS ship, where to be an officer, you have to be British. You can't be Irish. And they have those types of delineations. Yeah. So let's look at the case of Henry Every going after this treasure ship, going to India, the Indian treasure ship, and his attack by the crew. So what was this attack and how does this connect to your larger story?
So basically Every signs up for a expeditions called the Spanish Expedition Shipping. And the plan is to go, he's like the kind of the first mate on one of the ships, or there are four ships, including the ship, the Charles II, which is newly built, extremely fast in the water. And he heads off. They've got a plan to go to the Caribbean, and they're going to actually try and salvage some wrecks. And they've got some fancy British investors behind them. And they get hung up in Spain in this kind of bureaucratic tangle, and they're kind of stuck in a harbor for months, and they're not getting paid the way that they're supposed to get paid. So the crew gets increasingly restless, and finally Henry Every decides to basically mutiny. And there's a whole question about what actually happens in this mutiny and his relationship to the existing captain. But he ends up taking control of the ship, the Charles II, and they they rename it, they christen it the Fancy. It's a great name for a ship. And Every persuades the men to, a bunch of them are just like, well, let's just, you know, hop across the Atlantic and go, you know, to the Caribbean. But Every has this idea that they should actually sail all the way around Africa and all the way to into the Indian Ocean, where they can basically intersect ships coming back from Mecca, coming down the Red Sea, and these ships are kind of filled with enormous amounts of wealth and jewels and gold and silver, and there's a kind of spot there where there's a kind of a bottleneck where it's very easy to kind of pull off these heists, and so they set sail and do this extraordinary journey. They stop briefly at Madagascar. They do a little bit of kind of piracy on the way there, but that's their kind of their main goal. Now, the context of all this is at this point, India is arguably the wealthiest country in the world. It's run by a kind of despotic, the last great Mughal emperor, Aurangzeb. And Aurangzeb is probably the wealthiest person in the world. And he started to do this very lucrative business, trading largely kind of calico and chintz, these beautiful fabrics that were made in India, back to England through this new multinational corporation, the East India Company, that's just been around for about 70 or 80 years. And the East India Company is making this vast fortune importing these fabrics, which have become incredibly popular in England. And so their fate is very much tied to the good grace, being in the good graces of this emperor in India, Aurangzeb. And so that's kind of the context, basically. And Aurangzeb has sent off this treasure fleet of ships to go to Mecca, and where they do a bunch of trading as well as the kind of like religious ceremonies there. And then they're coming back to sail back to India in these treasure ships. And that's where they get intercepted by the pirates.
Huh. Okay, so one little bit of global trade here. I'm always interested in this. Mecca is for Muslim religious pilgrimages. Presumably those coming from India that lived close to ports would sail along the southern route, stop there, come back. For the trade of these materials that the East India Company would do, once they took them from India, stopped at the port of Mecca, would they then continue around the Horn of Africa, or would they then trade with traders in Egypt or elsewhere who would then move their goods overland through Europe and eventually to England, or would they trade in both directions by land or by sea?
I think it was both, actually, but we should just make it clear that the goods that the pirates are after, you know, are not the East India Company goods, right? This is all of Aurangzeb's, the Indian goods, right? So the East India Company is trading in what we now call the Middle East, but they're also then taking their goods all the way back by sea around the Horn of Africa back to London, where they would sell them. So there's trade kind of going in all different directions. The problem is that the British at this point have this reputation for being what they were called, you know, a nation of pirates, right? And so, you know, there are all these people working for the East India Company who are just trying to do proper trade, right? They've figured out this incredibly lucrative system where they get these fabrics and they buy them and then they sell them for this incredible markup back in London, and they're just making, you know, immense amount of money. And the other thing about the East India Company that we should note that makes them historically important is that they're the first joint stock company. So the first case where what we would now call a public company, where they're shares that are publicly traded in the company. And so for the first time, people are making money, not just by selling something and, you know, having a profit margin on it, but they're making money by investing in shares in a company, which then go up or down. And so people have made all this paper money from investing in these publicly traded shares in the East India Company. And so any potential threat to the East India Company and their dealings with India at this point has enormous kind of economic consequences for England and its entire kind of global emerging capitalist system that they're kind of inventing at that particular moment in time. So that's a big part of the context as well.
All right, it looks like our friend Henry is going to upset all sorts of apple carts, upsetting the most powerful nation or the wealthiest nation on Earth, and one of the biggest companies in England at the time. So with his attack on the Indian ship, what, first of all, how does that go down? And then what's the immediate aftermath of that?
Every ends up kind of ganging up with a couple of other pirate ships that have gathered at this exact same point at the mouth of the Red Sea, and they set sail. They almost lose. They almost kind of blow it when the treasure fleet comes by in the middle of the night, and they kind of miss them somehow, which is extraordinary. But then they set off in chase of them, and in part because the Fancy is so fast, it's able to catch up with the main kind of flagship, which is this enormous vessel. And it's a really interesting set of coincidences basically happen, which is actually right at the beginning of the book, which is Every and the Fancy should not have won this encounter. They were massively outmanned. You know, there were far more cannon on the Indian treasure ship, which had this great name. The ship was literally called, the translation of it was Exceeding Treasure or Excessive Treasure, right? I mean, you can't get more obvious in the branding than calling the ship. I mean, if you're trying to attract a bunch of pirates, like that's a pretty good way to do it. So Every probably, you know, should not have won this encounter, but basically two things happen in the space of a couple of minutes. The first is a cannon on board the Exceeding Treasure explodes, which could sometimes happen with cannons if they were either improperly manufactured or if they were poorly maintained. And an exploding cannon is like a bomb, right? I mean, it's an incredibly dangerous thing. So people are right, or the cannon crew right around it are just like literally, you know, their bodies are kind of dismembered by this. And it sets fire. So 10 or 20 people are, you know, mortally injured or seriously injured, and it sets fire to the deck of the ship. So just as they're kind of starting to kind of, you know, fire on the pirate ship, this bomb basically goes off on the side of the Indian ship. And then Every gets this incredibly lucky break where one of their initial cannon shots hits the main mast of the Indian ship and splits it in half, which is like a 1 in 100 shot. And so those two things happen simultaneously, and they give, you know, what is effectively the underdog in the fight this sudden advantage. And so Every is able to kind of hit his men board the ship, and they take control of the ship. It turns out that there are unusual for most maritime activity during this period. There are a remarkable number of women on board the ship who have made their pilgrimage to Mecca. They're there as like religious pilgrims. And so we don't know the exact details of it, but some kind of terrible set of, you know, kind of sexual attacks happen, rapes happen. On board the ship, not by Every himself, but by his men. And one of the passengers on the ship is rumored to have been Aurangzeb, the Grand Mughal of India, his granddaughter, or some kind of direct relation to his. And we don't really know that much about who this woman was. There's disputes about how directly she was related to Aurangzeb and all that. But the existence of this woman who was in some way potentially violated by these pirates becomes central to the story over the coming months and years. But in the end, they ultimately make out with the equivalent of something like $200 million worth of bounty. I mean, it's arguably one of the largest heists in the history of crime, depending on how you value it. And it's an extraordinary. It's an extraordinary heist with terrifying and, you know, incredibly offensive sexual violence bound up in it.
Hey everyone, Scott here. We're going to take a very short break for a word from our sponsors.
Judy was boring.
Hello.
Then Judy discovered Chumbacasino.com.
It's my little escape.
Now Judy's the life of the party.
Oh baby, mama's bringing home the bacon.
Whoa, take it easy, Judy. The Chumba life is for everybody. So go to ChumbaCasino.com and play over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Ch-ch-chumba. ChumbaCasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere. This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, no, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Yeah, if I were Great Britain, I would be mortified right now because the wealthiest nation on earth, we've personally insulted them if she was in fact the granddaughter of the Mughal emperor. And then they need to launch a manhunt, as your book indicates. So it's dangerous enough just to be able to reach your end destination around the world. And now you have to do this, but you have to find one particular person who could probably resourcefully disappear in any number of ports. So how do you do that?
Yeah, that's the thing that originally actually got me into this story. And then I realized there were so many other kind of layers to it. Because again, you know, we talked about the connection to terrorism before. It's in a real sense, Every becomes a kind of bin Laden-like figure in two ways, really. And the first is that with a small band of, you know, comrades, he triggers a truly global crisis, right? Aurangzeb is so offended by the stolen goods and by the attacks on his relative and other people in his extended court that he threatens to expel the East India Company from India, which would just have devastating consequences for them financially. They basically put the East India Company employees, both in Bombay and at Surat, another kind of major hub for them, under house arrest while they try and decide what to do. There's some question about like whether they're actually just going to get executed or a mob is going to run them over. And it's totally unclear whether the East India Company is going to continue doing business there. And so you've got this massive kind of global crisis. It's been triggered by the actions of like 100 men on a single ship, basically. So it's similar in a sense to the kind of global crisis that happened with 9/11. We have a very small number of people who are able to create these massive powers and get them, you know, kind of in conflict with each other. And then the other side of it is that once this happens, he does become the world's most wanted man. And there's a kind of a global manhunt out to get him. It's basically the British decide, okay, here's the deal. Like we need to make a clear public statement, both in terms of the East India Company and in terms of the crown, that we are not a nation of pirates and that we will not tolerate this. And basically the East India Company has to go back to the authorities in London and say, listen, we need to take a stand against piracy. Like we're going to go out of business and this is going to be catastrophic. We're going to lose our foothold in India. And so they basically announced this global manhunt for Henry Avery, and there's multiple kind of rewards put on this, you know, it's for whoever kind of finds him or any of his mates. And they dispatch notices all around the kind of growing British Empire, you know, we're looking for this person. And so it's really like the first global manhunt in the history of the world. And it was hard to do back in the day. You know, you couldn't just put a bulletin up on the internet and have people look out for this guy. You know, it took time basically to get the word out there. And the time was crucial for Avery and his crew.
How did the manhunt go? Were they able to make any headway or did Avery disappear?
I can't tell you the ending of the book.
As much as you're willing to
I
tease,
will say. You know? So amazingly, Avery decides to basically, they briefly stop over in Reunion near Madagascar. And a bunch of the crew kind of get off the ship and say, okay, we're done. But he then decides to sail basically without stopping. He knows if he goes in any port, he might be recognized. He's not getting like updates about what's happening in the news, right? He's like isolated. He has no way of like just checking in on CNN to see if the authorities are after him, right? So, but he assumes that he's probably, you know, become the most wanted man in the world. And so he convinces most of his crew to sail all the way back to the Bahamas, to Nassau, basically. Because he thinks he will probably get safe harbor there. And because it's kind of a crooked governor there who probably will receive him. And so he basically sails from kind of the far side of Madagascar all the way to the Bahamas without stopping in any ports along the way, which is, you think about doing that in 1695, that's pretty crazy. And then eventually I'll say a little bit about this without giving away too much of it. Some of his crew is captured. And one of the things that was so great about this book in terms of writing it is that they're brought to court in London, and it is effectively a show trial, right? They're trying to, like, they're putting these pirates who are associated with Every on trial, accusing them of these terrible crimes. And they want to, one, you know, win the case against them and execute them and make that a public statement that England is opposed to piracy. And so because of that, they hire a printer to publish a full transcript of the trial, and so that they can release it to the world as this kind of public statement that shows that the crown is opposed to this. And there's, you know, the actual kind of prosecution and judges involved in this are the highest kind of upper echelon of the legal kind of apparatus in England at the period. And so it's a little bit like, in terms of the focus on it and the people involved, it was as though the OJ trial were being heard by the US Supreme Court. That's the way I can describe it, right? It's like everybody's obsessed with this trial, and they brought in all the most prestigious figures in the entire British government to be part of it. And they've hired people to keep this transcript of it. And initially, it actually completely backfires because pirates at this point have become these folk heroes for precisely the reasons we talked about earlier, right? They're the people who are, you know, the kind of working class heroes. They're the people who have the most egalitarian economic systems. And yeah, they've committed these offenses against, you know, these women on an Indian ship. But, you know, this is a period of time where there's a lot of nationalism and racism and so on. And so people, you know, the ordinary jury doesn't really care so much about, you know, some people on the other half of the world. They care about these pirates who are their heroes. And so the initial version of the trial kind of fails catastrophically, and they're acquitted. And then through complicated mechanisms, they end up doing a second trial. And that trial is more successful. But the point of this for me as the author, which is so great, is that the transcript, particularly of the second trial, was published. And I actually had, I mean, just talk about amazing, you know, technology we have today for writing books. I have like a PDF of that trial that has survived, of that transcript. And over the course of that transcript, they tell the whole story and they interview all the pirates, and they describe the mutiny, they describe their crimes, they describe the discussion. And so there's all this dialogue that is directly quoted from the transcript of this trial that throughout the kind of the book, I'm able to quote dialogue from these people that is actual dialogue. Like, there's not a single line of dialogue in this book that is actually made up in any way, right? It's all from these official records. There's also some depositions that people are taking at that time. All this stuff has survived. And so as a kind of historian, to be able to write, you know, a book about events that happened, you know, hundreds of years ago, and to be able to tell some of these, have these scenes that are very kind of cinematic in a way, that involve the actual exchanges between people in the mutiny or in this court scene, it was a great opportunity just as a kind of storyteller.
Something I'm really curious about with the trial, England is making a big show out of this, and partly for their own efforts to show that they're a nation of law and order, but is there an element too of trying to make good with the Mughal court? Are they immediately translating this into Persian and then delivering it on a silver platter back to the Mughal Empire and saying, oh, by the way, we cut off some heads of the mutineers, or they are on a platter. Please forgive us. Don't kick us out of India.
Yes. I mean, it's an excellent question of like what translations were made. And I don't actually know the answer to that, but in a sense, Aurangzeb is the unseen long distance audience for the whole trial. And certainly this was being relayed back to the East India Company representatives, in Bombay and in Surat, who then were kind of dealing with other conduits that would get information to Aurangzeb and his court. And some of the direction for how this response should be kind of structured was coming from the people in India, basically, like coming from the East India Company, people who were in Bombay and in Surat, that they were like, this is the time to make a stand. And it was their insistence that led to this trial in the first place. So it ultimately seems to have appeased Aurangzeb. There was some settlement in terms of recompensating him, and he seemed to ultimately be convinced that it wasn't actually East India Company people who had committed this crime. And this is a really important thing, because if you think about it in terms of the history of it all, think about kind of alternate paths the world could have taken. If, in fact, the British had not successfully appeased Aurangzeb with this show trial and with the arguments that they made on the ground in India, and the East India Company had been ejected from India and had lost their kind of monopoly on trade that they had, that had been so lucrative. Yes, the economic, consequences of that would have been, severe for the shareholders in the East India Company at that particular moment in time. But the bigger significance of this is that I think there's a very convincing argument that the British Empire in India would not have formed as it did, 60 or 70 years later. I mean, basically what ended up happening is the East India Company kind of slowly took control of this subcontinent. And then you had British rule in India for a period of, at least a full century. And that rule evolved out of the East India Company's occupation of the Indian subcontinent. So just think about how important the British Empire in India was to world history, to the history of both of those countries. If Evry's crime had not been, if the British government had not shown their real antipathy towards the pirates successfully, and they had somehow actually had the East India Company ejected from India, the whole course of the next 100 or 200 years in the relationship between England and India would have been transformed, I think. So it's one of these little turning points where something, in a weird way, in a weird sense, something doesn't happen that, mm-hmm. that came very close to happening. And we tend to not tell stories about that in classic history accounts of the world, right? We tend to focus on the events that did happen. But sometimes I think it's equally important to look at these turning points where, like, the world got very close to a completely different result. And I think this is one of those stories.
There's an alternate history in there somewhere that could be told, definitely. And I want to follow up on your point there, which I think is an intriguing historical argument that an act of piracy led to the birth of multinational capitalism. So from what you could see, the fact that England dealt with this, they made a show trial, apparently they appeased the Mughal Empire, and the East India Company was able to continue trade. Henry Every's action, did that change anything in how England acted, the East India Company acted, that affected the trajectory of what the East India Company was doing that makes England this early globalist power? Or was it something that they were able to patch things up and they weren't kicked out, and they're not being kicked out is the real story? What do you think?
Yeah, I think in terms of what did happen, the major turning point was the government officially changing its line on piracy, right? That what had been a very blurry kind of ethical line up and legal line up until that point, where you could be Francis Drake and be a completely legitimate figure in society. After Evry, it was clear that piracy and that kind of economic organization too, both the kind of negative things and also the kind of the positive progressive things about the pirate collective, that the pirate ship after that point became much more clearly an operation that was working outside the law. And, you did continue to have a kind of golden age of piracy after that, but those people were clearly had chosen to be illegitimate actors. And Evry's crimes really are the turning point in terms of that. In terms of the East India Company, I think, what you would have seen you know, I think you would have seen trade continuing with India, just with more actors, you know, multiple companies, some of them English, some of them, you know, Dutch and Portuguese. You would have seen a whole range of folks instead of the close to monopoly that the East India Company had. And I think the joint stock multinational corporation was probably going to happen no matter what. There were a lot of forces leading to it happening, but had the East India Company itself collapsed, like it probably would have gone bankrupt if it had lost the India trade. And so you would have seen kind of locally a lot of different things play out had this crisis not been kind of ultimately averted. But I think the long-term trends of multinational capitalism forming and joint stock companies, I think that was probably on enough of a stable track that it would have continued.
Well, Stephen, thank you for sharing all this. And one last question regarding this story. What do you think it says that a pirate arguably created the modern world and modern globalism and multinational capitalism?
Well, I think it's not so much that he created it all, but he forced these new emerging institutions to kind of define their boundaries more clearly, right? And to wrestle with some blurry kind of edge cases that they hadn't really had to wrestle with. And the other thing that's important in all this that we didn't really even touch on is there's also a global kind of media network that's happening as well during this period.
And right.
Every's crimes were transmitted by a whole kind of network of pamphleteers, actually balladeers, people who would like sit on the street and sell kind of little proto newspapers, but they would sing the news. And Every himself was written about at length. There were a number of like fake autobiographies written in his name. There was a multiple plays written about his account. And so there was a kind of a media system that was emerging at this point. And a lot of that media got attention and sold copy by writing stories about crimes and famous criminals. And pirates were the ultimate criminal, right? They were these daring, you know, entrepreneurs on the sea who were also ruthless killers and self-made men and, you know, working class heroes. It was kind of the perfect mix. And so not only is every story bound up in a kind of the emergence of multinational capitalism, but there's also a kind of like tabloid media system that he plays a role in as well. So it's one of the reasons why it's such a rich story to explore from a kind of cultural historian's perspective, because there's so many emerging forms that are happening right there that Every's escapades are absolutely at the center of during those years.
Yeah, this is the era of the rise of the print sphere, as what the Jürgen Habermas term. And
yeah,
now you have your tabloid figure to be able to launch this and really kick this off. So that's another really good point. And balladeers, perhaps that can make a comeback. I don't have a great singing voice, so I can't do that on my podcast. If you happen to, then that could spice things up.
Let's keep it in prose here.
Okay, sounds good. Stephen, thanks for sharing all this. Your book is Enemy of All Mankind, A True Story of Piracy, Power, and History's First Global Manhunt. And as I alluded to, you also have a podcast. So where can people find that? And where's a good place to find you online with everything else that you're involved in?
Yeah, I've got to do a podcast on kind of the history of innovation, which a lot of my books have been about, called American Innovations. You know, you go anywhere and you listen to podcasts, you search for it, you'll find it. And my info is at StephenBerlinJohnson.com with up-to-date info on my books and other projects.
Great. I'll link all that in the show notes. People can check that out. Stephen, thank you for joining us.
Hey, it was a real pleasure.
Okay, well, that wraps things up for today's episode. Thank you so much for sticking with me to the end. Once again, I want to start things off by thanking the Spymasters of History Unplugged. I'll explain what that is in a second. Our Spymasters include Bill Ivey, Moondoggy from Ohio, Tom from Ohio, Ryan Gillen, Rob from Chicago, Nick Brooks, Michael from New York, Carl from Norway, Josh Reddick, Jennifer French Lee, Jay Carrington, The McCrays, David Santee, Chris C., and Baron Fraser. If you'd like to support the show, there's some very easy ways to do so. First, go to the site halfpricehistory.com. I've worked out an arrangement with a lot of the authors who've appeared on this show, and you can go there and get their books for 50% off. All you have to do is go to halfpricehistory.com, and under the promo code UNPLUGGED at checkout, Second, please leave a review and subscribe to this podcast on your favorite podcast player of choice, whether Apple Podcasts or Spotify or Stitcher or whatever. Third, join our Facebook group. You can go to Facebook and search for History Unplugged. There, you can talk with other fans of the show about recent episodes, what you liked, what you didn't like. Also, I have exclusive content there, such as live streams, where I do live versions of podcast episodes, where you can leave feedback as I'm talking, and I will address it on air. Last, and I think this is the best, is to join our membership program, the Knowlton's Rangers. The Knowlton's Rangers were George Washington's spies during the Revolutionary War, but it's also the name of the membership program for History Unplugged. If you go to patreon.com/unplugged, you can join the membership program at three levels. If you join at the Scout level, you'll get all 400 episodes of History Unplugged absolutely ad-free and early access to new episodes. If you join at the second level, the Intelligence Officer level, get all the stuff that Scouts get, along with bonus episodes. There's currently about 40 of them, including series on Audie Murphy and Operation Long Jump about the Nazi attempt to assassinate FDR, Churchill, and Stalin in 1943. Finally, if you join at the Spymaster level, you'll get a shout-out to you and or your business at the end of each episode. You get a 3-pack of hardcover history books, and you can find out what those are if you go to patreon.com/unplugged. Finally, you can ask me a question about history on absolutely any topic on earth, and I will research it and devote an entire episode to your question. Probably about 30% of the questions in the archive for the show have been based on these sorts of questions. So there you go. Go to patreon.com/unplugged to learn more. All right, well, that is all for today's episode. Thank you so much for listening, and I'll see you next time.
They were some of the most powerful men who've ever lived. They've waged war, forged peace, and altered the fates of billions of people. And yet, they were just as human, just as flawed as you and me. They were the presidents of the United States, and they are the subjects of the history podcast, This American President. In each episode of This American President, we explore how flawed men have managed this awesome responsibility. To listen now, go to ParthenonPodcast.com or search This American President on your favorite podcast platform.